So this is tactics for defending the faith in everyday interactions. And the good news is, if you weren't here for the first introductory week, I'm basically going to, in short fashion, sort of paraphrase that material. But just very, very briefly, for those of you that weren't here last week, I'm Chris. What I spend my effort doing is doing a ministry at UC Irvine with a ministry called Ratio Christi, which is Latin for Reason of Christ. And some of this material, the reason I'm passionate about it is because it's born out of my interest in wanting our nation and our culture to move in the right direction and to be amenable to Christianity. If our culture slides into a direction where you can't even talk about Christianity as a viable option, if people think it's just fairy tales, then we sort of lost our opportunity, right? To both live as Christians and to be compelling in our case. So this is something I'm passionate about, and even though I'm up here talking from the front, I'm a big-time student myself of this. You know, I'm learning. I once heard that some of the best teachers are ones who are just one step ahead of the students, and I'm maybe half a step ahead. So let me open prayer, and then we'll start talking. God, thank you for this evening. Thank you that you give us a reason to live, God, and that you have called us sons and daughters and given us a task to spread the good news that other people can be adopted into your family as well. We love you, and we ask that you would enliven our minds and our hearts to accept your exhortation and your knowledge. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. So since everybody is already snickering because they secretly looked ahead at the comic strip, let's look at that. Oh, loading. Oh, okay. The downside of cloud-based computing is waiting for things to load from the internet. You know the difference between a philosopher and a large pepperoni pizza?
No.
A large pepperoni pizza can feed a family of four. Okay, so that's a freebie. So we'll come back around to this reductio ad absurdum idea in a little bit, but I found a funny example of it in this Dilbert cartoon. Is everybody here familiar with Dilbert? You guys look like a little young. Millennials. Are you millennials? I don't know where the cutoff is. Yeah. So Dilbert's boss says, by the way, just FYI, Dilbert is a office guy, and he's always having issues at work. Funny issues. Anyways, Dilbert's boss says, we ranked all the engineers from best to worst. We plan to get rid of the bottom 10%. That includes you, Wally. Oh, that's actually not Dilbert. That's Wally, his coworker. Your plan is logically flawed. If you fire the bottom 10%, you'll still have a bottom 10%. You'll fire and fire, but there will always be a bottom 10% until finally, when less than 10 people are left, you'll have to fire body parts instead of whole people. We'll have torsos and glands wandering around, unable to use keyboards, blood and bile everywhere. And Dilbert says, how did it go? He fired my hair. It's an example of reducing somebody's view to absurdity, right? He's showing the logical consequence of, if you take the view you're stating to its to the full logical end, it's got problems. Okay, so let's just this will be new for some of you, but review for some of you. But let me just sort of break down where we're coming from in this class. We're sort of setting the scene for our interaction with unbelievers, okay? So the general idea from the big picture is the Great Commission, right? We're making disciples. That's a really important thing. It's the last thing that Christ commanded his followers, which would develop into the church. That's us now. That's his big directive for us, is go make disciples all over the place, whether it's Jerusalem or the ends of the earth. So what I want to do in this class is not try to convince you through my powers of persuasion to do something you wouldn't ordinarily do. What I am trying to do is exhort myself and all of us here to take that serious, right? Not to not sort of sit on the sidelines and say, well, somebody else is an evangelist, but I don't really want to be uncomfortable and tell somebody about my faith. Well, hopefully this method of graciously interacting that we're discovering here and playing out is a way not only to do that successfully, but to do it in a way where you don't have to be so worried about being Billy Graham or Ravi Zacharias. So the idea is, wherever you find yourself, whatever situation, whatever context, that God is strategically got you there for a reason, right? You are to bloom where you're planted is the idea. So whether you're a student, a mother, a grandmother, a business professional, all of those situations, the beautiful thing is that God is working through everybody's situation. And think about the poignancy and the beauty of that. You may be strategically and uniquely poised where God has you to affect somebody that other people can't get inside with. Does that make sense? So whatever our situation is, I'm exhorting us to look for divine appointments, I call them, right? Moments where you recognize that there's an opportunity, and it's almost uncanny sometimes. Wow, this is an opportunity, and I'm at a tipping point. Am I going to back off and say, I don't really want to deal with that? Or are you going to, at the tipping point, fall forward into it, a little bit of the unknown, but let God use the situation for you to encounter somebody and, I say, move them in the direction towards the gospel. Now, the biggest dare is just to start talking to somebody, right? Whether you know them or not. So there are lots of ways that you can spread the gospel or affect people. So why are we talking about interacting with people's beliefs? Well, I acknowledge and celebrate all these different ways of interacting with people, but you've probably noticed that we live in a day and age, there's a lot of turmoil, there's a lot of things a lot of things tend to be upside down and wide open. People believe such a vast variety of things, and they're affected by a lot of different ideas tacitly, right? They don't even necessarily know in depth what they believe, but they carry around slogans that they've borrowed from media or from other thinkers. So we're sort of in this position as the church, as individuals, where we need to engage people's beliefs in such a way that we're moving them forward. I won't pull it up, but in there, from the previous week, there was a scale called the diagnostic scale, right? So if you have somebody that's completely wholeheartedly postmodern, they have a big time problem with any authority claim, whether it's political or religious or moral. They just react to that. They say, and because of that reaction, they'll make a statement like, there is no absolute truth. right? So that, I'm sorry? What's that? Right, right. Yeah, there's no absolute truth, absolutely, right? There's no absolute truth, absolutely, or relatively. Okay, so point being is, that person, if you were to make a scale from -9 to 0, where 0 is them accepting the gospel, being at a place where they can accept it, and -9 is being not ready to accept the gospel, the postmodern thinker is going to be at like a -9. So remember the parable of the soils, right? There's some soil that's good and the seeds sprout up and people harvest the crop, right? The harvest is plenty, the workers are few. But all the people that aren't at that -1, like right before being ready to be picked, the rest of them are all rocky soil and soil with weeds and soil that needs cultivation. So what does cultivating soil look like versus harvesting? Cultivating soil looks like somebody that's postmodern that you're interacting with that has a problem with absolute truth claims, taking them forward on that scale, right? They're at -9 and they need to be at -1 to receive the gospel, but you've got to go through a lot of talking and a lot of interacting to help them get over those obstacles to the gospel. That's a very different paradigm than we've been in traditionally, historically, you know, over the ages. So that's why I say we're in a very different and special time now, where the needs that we have for promoting Christianity are different. Again, not neglecting any of those other methods. Those are also effective. But we can't ignore this type of interaction. So we want to overcome those obstacles that we can help dismantle through gracious interactions. And we want to be gracious but tactful, or tactile. Or you could say we want to be tactful but tactical, right? Scripture calls us to be gracious and gentle, but we're also to be shrewd and to season everything with salt so that we can compel people with the gospel. Okay, so here's an image, right? Imagine this. This is a very, you know, general or vague interaction, but this is what I mean by trying to harvest from rocky soil. This person is ready to give the gospel, and they're shouting it from the rooftops, the gospel. And the other person, in their thought, in their mind, is saying, nothing outside of the natural world exists. They're convinced that there is no supernatural. How are you going to convey that there is a supernatural resurrection that is the fundamental thing of Christianity, right? Paul said, if this doesn't stand, then everything falls. But they can't even accept the supernatural. So that's not the time for you to just lay out the basic gospel. That's important, and we want to do that at a point. But what we need to do is take them from this naturalism that they believe in and move them forward on the scale. Move them to a point to where they can hear the gospel and not consider it just outlandish and mythical. So the fundamental, when we say tactics, these are sort of ways of engaging people. This is a method. There's both an overall method, as it were, and then there are specific things we can learn about how reason and logic work that can help us in our interactions. So here's just a simple breakdown of the first tactic, which was called Columbo. And again, there's a generation gap. Columbo was before my time, too, but I'm old enough that I saw reruns, let's put it that way. But only in syndication. I'm not that old. So Columbo is this detective, and he looks kind of dingy, like he slept in his trench coat, and he's always got a cigar in his fingers, scratching his head, and he looks kind of dumb. And everybody thinks that they've got one over on him, right? Like they're going to get away with the crime because they got this dumb detective trying to figure out their case. But he's always walking back in the door asking questions going, oh, one more thing. How is it that, you know, you said they called, but they were supposed to be at this other place. How could they make a phone? You know, he's asking these questions and putting him on the spot. But he's always asking questions. He never comes out and says, you did this, you did that. He just comes out with questions. And he leads them, he sort of entraps them, really, is what he does, into almost admitting their crime. Or being stuck in a position where they can't explain it anymore. So that's sort of the soul of this first sort of mother of all tactics. It's called Columbo tactic. So there's basically several ingredients to it. So first of all, of course, if you're going to interact with somebody, you have to interact with them, right? So this is probably the hardest part when I say you're sort of daring yourself to do it. I mean, it's not the easiest thing to walk up to a stranger and start talking to them. And I do want to point out that it doesn't have to be a stranger. We always think of evangelism as I got to go find somebody on the sidewalk that I have to talk to versus what about blooming where you're planted? What about people in your own life? We'll talk more about that in a second, but we can be on the lookout for a reason to converse, and if you need a reason, you can find a reason. Somebody's t-shirt slogan, somebody's tattoo, somebody's bumper sticker. Like, you've all seen the coexist bumper sticker, right? Anybody that has a coexist bumper sticker on their car, you can have a conversation with them. They're promoting a view on their car. Really, any bumper sticker would be a good conversation starter, right? Because they're basically saying, I agree with this. So it's as simple as asking, well, what does that mean? Right? That's basically the first step. What do you mean by that? Oh, coexist. What does that bumper sticker mean? Or what do you... You could say, why do you have that bumper sticker on your car? Something like that. And then they'll express an idea, right? That bumper sticker could mean several things, couldn't it? I mean, it could mean all religions lead to God. It could mean we should live peaceably, even though we have different ideas. So you're not sure what they mean by it until you do a little fact-finding, right? You got to find out what they believe before you interact with what they believe. So you ask what, that's the what part. And then you're asking sort of the why, like why do you believe that? How did you come to that conclusion? And by the way, if you're skittish at all of having these interactions, it's how simple is it to actually use these exact questions, right? If you don't feel like you can be extemporaneous, these two questions are straight out of this book, Tactics, Greg Kokel. So it can be as simple as memorize those two questions, and that's it. So the longer plan is, after you've interacted and sort of found out what they believe and why they believe it, leading questions, that's the third step. So what's a leading question? Well, you're still questioning, right? You're still sort of driving from the back seat, as it were. You're not proposing a view. You're asking about their view. So you're still in control, but you're not offending, and you're actually genuinely interested in them. So leading questions would be things like, okay, now that I know that they're promoting the view that all roads lead to God, and then they say some statement about why they believe that, like they say, they might say something like, all religions promote love or something like that. So what you want to do is, ultimately what we want to do with the gospel is show the uniqueness of Christianity, and there's a unique need, or there's a universal need and a unique solution, right, in Christianity. So how can we lead them to that conclusion? Well, we use leading questions like, you could say something like, have you compared different religions? Have you studied different religions? or tell me about how Christianity and Hinduism are similar, right? So you already have an idea in mind of the gospel and ways of getting there. One of the things I talked about last week was being being your own personal Google Maps, right? There's one destination on the map that we're trying to get everybody to, and that's Christ. But they're coming from all different initial points. So if this is their initial point, I got to take a path that's appropriate to where they're coming from. And that's what the leading questions are. It's like the turns in the directions. Like, this is how I'm going to get them there. And then ultimately, much further down the road, maybe after several interactions, after leading questions, that puts you in a position to sometimes make statements and actually propose your view, because they have a need for their view. I'm sorry, they have a need because they see a deficiency in how they're trying to live, or what they're espousing as a worldview isn't working based on the reductio ad absurdum. We'll talk about that in a second. But and if this is a gracious interaction and you're developing a decent relationship and there's trust there and it's an actual interaction, at some point they're going to ask you questions, right? This guy's safe. He's not at my throat. He actually cares about what I think. Then they're going to have the peace with you to hopefully say, well, what do you think? Or, well, yeah, that does seem to be a problem. What's the answer, right? Okay, so one quick point. I've laid all, maybe that sounds like a lot, I don't know. But think about an initial interaction with somebody, right? Like, say you came tonight and you're like, yeah, I guess that's true. Maybe I should talk to Bob because he knows I'm a Christian, but we never talk about it. And maybe I should start that dialogue. And you're thinking, oh, I gotta lead him all the way to the gospel, like through all these different questions and concepts. Well, I think our interaction can be very modest, right? One of the things I challenged us to do is to just take, at least over the course of this course, to take one risk, you know, to have one conversation and see how it goes. Do one session of fact-finding like this. And if all you did was get through step one or step one and two, that's okay. We don't have to feel like I've got to lead everybody to say the Lord's Prayer, the sinner's prayer in every interaction. And that also keeps it gracious where they don't feel like you're trying to sell them, you know, the greatest vacuum that's ever existed, right? You're not just a salesman. Okay, well, I'll give you an example, but any questions or comments before I give an example? Okay. So here's an example from the book. It's the night of your weekly Bible study group, and during the discussion of the Sunday sermon on the Great Commission, a newcomer remarks, "Who are we to say Christianity is better than any other religion? I think the essence of Jesus' teaching is love, the same as all religions. It's not our job to tell other people how to live or believe." Right? So this is a paraphrase of some potential questions. These would be sort of leading questions that would move somebody to think about what they just said. How much have you studied other religions to compare the details and find a common theme? Why would the similarities be more important than the differences? I'm curious, what do you think Jesus' own attitude was on this issue? Isn't telling people to love one another just another example of telling them how they should live and believe? So those are all questions they may not have. They sort of just have this surface idea, but they haven't dug down to think about the implications of it. Now, I'm going to offer a way for us to practice this in just a moment, but I want to... I gave that as an example of a reductio, but I'm adding in a little, you know, traditional logic, just so as you are thinking and reading and coming across other material, and somebody says reductio ad absurdum, you'll know what they're talking about. And that's really what the Colombo tactic is, kind of in a nutshell, is taking somebody's view, right? Say they're a religious pluralist. And through a series of questions, leading them to sort of explode their own view from the inside out. They're sort of left with a view that is hanging by a thread and doesn't work anymore. So you're reducing the view to absurdity. But in this case, we're doing it through questions rather than saying, I'm going to make a statement about why your view is wrong. So a couple ways of saying it, is the view acceptable when taken to its full logical consequences? And if the logical consequences of the view don't fit with what we already know, then the view's suspect, right? So if pluralism leads to the view that Christianity is true, because all religions are true, and Christianity has exclusive claims, then that's an unacceptable consequence for your view. Okay, so if we want to set ourselves up to practice this Colombo tactic, we want to know, like the map idea, right? You want to know where they're coming from. And there's a previous slide in there that talks about perfecting the Colombo tactic. There's sort of three steps. You anticipate what you're going to run into. You go out there and interact, and then you assess how it went so you can... give yourself self-feedback and do better next time, or do the best you can. And there's a third on there, allowed, practice aloud. So when you practice again, you actually do it verbally to yourself in the mirror or whatever, or with a friend, so that when you're out there interacting, you're not just sort of getting up out of your chair and saying, this is important, yeah, I should go do it, and you're going out with no practice and no rehearsal at all. So if we're going to anticipate, I'm hoping you guys can throw out some ideas to me of what sort of people you might interact with. And I think this will do two things. It'll give us ideas, and I hope that it'll challenge you as you think of these people that they're a live option for you, actually, rather than somebody you haven't shared with before. So in your sphere of influence, whether it's school or wherever, what kind of people do you think God might put in your path? Maybe you have already interacted with some of these people, maybe you haven't.
Well, I live in a senior citizen community, and we all have little, like, bungalows. Uh-huh. Where I live, four attached, and they're all, you know, you see them out guarding, you see them walking their cars.
Mm-hmm.
You see them a lot.
Right. And you already bump into them and have conversations anyways, right? So that would be what, neighbors?
Neighbors.
But that's good, right? Because that means they have something they want to say.
Yeah, but they're hard nuts to crack.
Yeah. Yeah. Who else?
Coworkers.
What does that interaction look like? Do you have moments where this would be an appropriate conversation? Yeah.
Why you disagree with something? It's like really good for being able to start on.
Right. It might be even better if you have a job you don't like because you both want to talk rather than do your job. But that's sort of like the water cooler idea, right? Talks, conversations that happen at the water cooler. Yeah. If you want to be a good Christian, do your job well. Don't evangelize instead of doing your job. What other... for me, it would be students, because I'm on campus a lot. I mean, if you were to challenge yourself to look for somebody in your sphere of influence that... got to be others. Yeah. Like immediate family, extended family.
Immediate, extended, for instance, my father was Jewish and my mother was a fallen away Christian. So we got Jews on one side and Christian missionaries on the other. So there's a lot of times if they want it wrong, there's lots of opportunities.
Right. Okay, so we illustrated the point. If you just think about your everyday life, you don't have to go... There's a sense in which you're outside of your comfort zone when you step out and you say, I'm going to go ahead and have this interaction. But there's another sense in which it's all already within your comfort zone, as it were. These are all situations you already have every day. And you don't have to go looking for them. They're already coming to you. Now, this could be a related or a separate question, but at the risk of generalizing, sometimes we can sort of know a person in general and sort of guess where they're coming from in general. Like, are they, you know, do they hate religion? Do they like to party? I don't know. I mean, you can sort of get a sense of where they're coming from. If you're going to anticipate what sort of things you're going to ask them questions about, you kind of need to know where they're coming from. So, in general, what sort of belief system do they promote? Yeah, in general, in the people you interact with every day, what sort of people are they? Are they religious people? Are they secular? Do they spend all their energy on sports? You know, I mean, you see what I'm saying? There's, we don't have to make a list, but if you think about that, that'll affect what you might study, what your entry point might be. And then based on those, what sort of people, I guess it would be what context the people are in, and then where they're coming from, what issues and what issues they might have with Christianity, because that's one of the things we want to do is remove obstacles. So it's going to be a lot different if it's somebody that has almost no exposure to Christianity versus somebody who just graduated from a Cal State school and hates Christians. That's going to be a different entry point. So based on those, we're going to develop some questions for practice, or we're anticipating. If you don't like the idea of anticipating, just go have an interaction and then you'll know what to anticipate. I had a gentleman at a ministry table at an apologetics conference for Mormonism. Or apologetics to Mormons, not for Mormonism. And a gentleman came up to me and we hit it off, and he seemed well studied, but he is saying, I just don't talk to people because I'm scared of what I don't know, and I don't think I could say it well. And he had a list of things that he was fearful about, all fears that I've had and still sometimes have. And I said, it just occurred to me at that moment, and this makes sense. It's one of those things where it makes perfect sense to me, but I hadn't thought of it until that moment. I thought, you know, you're passionate about this, and you should be ministering to people for, you know, the next however many years, 20, 40, 60 years. But if you stop there and you get up to the edge and you say, no, I can't do it. No, I can't do it. And you keep backing off. At some point, you got to jump in and mess up, make some mistakes, find out what you need to know that you don't already know. And that's a very small amount of time on the timeline, right? If we're talking about 40 years of ministry, that's a very small and important cost to pay right up front to get your feet wet, find out what you need, right? So if this is too academic for you, just go talk to a stranger and you'll know what to anticipate. So then the idea is to role play it and then go out and try it in everyday situation. So we have the comfort of our classroom here where we can kind of do that. So what I want to do is give you a role play. Okay, so here's your scenario. You're hosting a dinner party at your home for some of your close friends from church. The conversation ranges naturally over a number of interesting spiritual topics. Suddenly, to your surprise and embarrassment, your 15-year-old son announces with some belligerence that he doesn't believe in God anymore. "It's simply not rational," he says. "There's no proof." You had no idea he'd been moving in this direction. There's a stunned silence. What will you say? Okay, so here's your first chance to take a risk. You guys can, there's enough of us that we can break into a couple of groups. So one person's going to take the role of the 15-year-old, and the other person is going to be the host. The host and the 15-year-old. That's right. So one person is announcing that they don't believe in God, and then as the conversation goes on, you're acting as that person. And the other person is going to do their best to use what we're talking about and kind of do steps one and two, really. What do you mean by that? How did you come to that conclusion? Or variations on that, right? So you're going to tease out where they're coming from. So it looks like we can do two groups. Or actually, we could do three groups if I do with one person. I'm going to turn my microphone off. So if we could do three groups of two, and then we'll see what worked and what didn't. Am I on? Okay. You guys are really getting into it right here.
Oh, this is rough.
All right. So Rod had a good question for me. What's an everyday situation? That's kind of a slippery concept, isn't it? I mean, some people interact with their neighbors, and some people, I've lived next to people. I mean, I think growing up, we lived next to people that I had never saw in 20 years or interacted with.
They didn't want it.
Yeah, there was no interaction, so. Every day is a relative term, but. So how did that go? How did that feel?
Well, it's hard to get it back to where you want to go because, you know, there's so many ideas.
Yeah.
When you start out.
Well, I sort of gave you a long time, so you probably went too far beyond the fact finding. So who played the, I'm interested in the reaction from the people who played the host. You were the host?
You asked the question, you're trying to get, that what you mean?
Yeah, not the 15-year-old, but the,
yeah, okay.
The host.
Yeah, I started out being the 15-year-old.
What was your initial, what was your entry point? What was your initial way of response or getting in, reacting to what they said?
Mm-hmm. What gave you that notion to come up with those ideas or those feelings?
Yeah. That's good. Who is the... Yeah. Okay. Now, one of the good things, just reminding myself that when that person makes that statement and then you come back with a question, it starts you on the trail of them proving their case rather than you trying to prove your case. So the burden of proof is on the person who brought that up, right? There's something superior about that, as practically speaking, than just shouting out, Christianity is true, and here are the reasons. There's a place for that, but in this kind of interaction, you don't have the liability of sort of standing up as a target, right? You're dealing with the other person's statement and then breaking that down, rather than saying, here's all the reasons you should believe in God, and then just being a target practice for them to come up with as many possible reasons why they can knock that down. Yeah. Right. Right.
But that's where you really have to start, because otherwise you're just shotgun blazing all over the place and maybe not even addressing the reasons.
Right. And I think there's wisdom, right? Because let's say that you were a street preacher and, you know, turn or burn sign and shouting on the street corner all day, every Saturday, right? And you did it for 4 weeks in a row, and then finally somebody converted, and you'd say, yeah, see, it works, right? Well, that's maybe that one person needed a certain approach, but what about all the other people that you couldn't interact with successfully because you didn't have the wisdom to think about, okay, where is this person coming from? How should I approach them? Maybe that one person was ripe for the picking, as it were. Okay, other observations from your interaction? Well, Rod had a good point that the examples... the scenario is a little bit loaded, right? Because if you might want to take them aside and talk to them about it later, right? And not, rather than in front of all your church guests. so that's a good point. That might be wise, but... So how far were you able to continue asking questions, or did you find yourself wanting to make a case? Do you know what I mean? Were you able to tease out their view by asking questions, or at some point did you want to just tell them why they're wrong?
I was trying to ask her questions that would lead her into, then I could say something. Would start a conversation, but then she'd want to go off in a different direction. So we didn't.
Yeah. Okay, good. All right. Now, and one last question, and then we'll take a little break. Can you imagine yourself in a... I mean, this is a role play, right? But can you imagine yourself in some familiar situation you might find yourself in, kind of in some of the situations we were thinking about, right? Can you imagine yourself starting this sort of conversation with this sort of question-based approach? I mean, does this seem realistic, right? Does that give you any... for me, it gives me a little bit of confidence, a little bit of... I feel like it takes me off the... What's the cliche? It takes the spotlight off me a little bit, right? I don't have to like suddenly be the ultimate spokesperson. All I have to do is ask questions to start. At some point down the road, maybe we need a little more knowledge because we want to be able to tease out the concepts. But okay, let's take a break, water break. There's actually a coffee maker in there if anybody needs coffee. And let's take a few minutes, and then we'll come back and talk about another tactic. All right, let's reconvene here and go through a little bit more. Yeah, speaking of marriage, as we were during the break, it's hard to imagine myself not having been affected by my wife. Like, I can't believe how much better of a person I am because of her. It's kind of scary to think of who I'd be if I didn't have my wife. So that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you guys all knew who Aristotle is? Aristotle. Good old Aristotle. So, except for in some very nuanced ivory tower discussions, generally his laws of thought, his laws of logic still hold. So it's basically the law of identity. The law of excluded middle. You know, I have to write on the board because one of my heroes is R.C. Sproul. And if you ever watch an old R.C. Sproul video, he's got a chalkboard and he's writing all sorts of things on there. Anyways. And the last one is non-contradiction, the law of non-contradiction. Okay, so why do I bring that up? I bring that up because the Colombo tactic is based almost like a methodology, right? It's like a way of engagement. It's sort of a standard operating procedure. And the most of the rest of the tactics we'll talk about are basically variations of observing the logic of somebody's view, right? Logic is just basically a set of principles by which we find out whether something makes sense or not, right? You can tell whether something's a valid idea or not with some simple logic. So this rule of non-contradiction is basically that something can't, I know this is going to sound really ridiculously simple, but as we observe other people's views, you'll find out that they're breaking these rules. It just isn't so quite obvious until you observe it carefully. So the rule of non-contradiction is that something can't be true and not true at the same time, right? Like, let's see, what's an example? Well, I don't need an example. We'll get to the examples in a second. But I'm bringing that up because I just want to display that classic logic, you know, just this is very straightforward, you know, things like something can't be true and not true at the same time. That's very basic, right? Or the law of excluded middle. There's nothing in between it being true and not true. It's either true or not true. It can't be somewhere in the middle. Or the law of identity just says that A is A. That's not very controversial. So I bring these up because some of these will play in, like this next tactic, suicide. That's sort of a popular way of saying a self-refuting view. Is basically a statement that breaks the rule of non-contradiction. It's trying to say something is and isn't at the same time. I'm sorry?
Could you explain that about suicide?
Yeah, so what's wrong with the what's wrong with these pictures? In one, yeah, that's such a weird picture. Yeah, so in the head, it's a guy sitting on a tree branch and he's sawing off the branch, but he's sitting on the side that's going to fall off, right? So you're cutting off the branch you're sitting on. So it's called suicide. Well, what is suicide? Suicide is killing yourself, right? So a view can commit suicide, just by hearing the statement, it's a suicidal view because it kills itself in what it says. I should really give examples because that'll make it clear here. Let's see. Okay. What if I said, my brother is an only child? Right? That's self-refuting. If the statement is true, it's also false. What was the rule of non-contradiction? Something can't be true.
Defining the circumstances, one by yes. False person.
That's true. Yes. In any intuition test that a philosopher does in a classroom, there will always be ways of trying to get around it, and there will always be ways of carving up the story so that you still have to deal with the intuition. I was definitely the student in philosophy classes that would always try to find a way around.
And I was a student that couldn't
understand it. Okay, so what are some others? If I say, I can't think of anything to say. Yeah, so if the statement's true, it's false. Statements like that refute themselves because they break the rule of non-contradiction. Now, some of these are a little more pertinent to things we'll run into, right? There's no truth. Or you shouldn't judge. Does that count for you making that statement as well? The only source of truth is science. Or here's a variation on that. The only things we can know are things we can verify with empirical tests. What's wrong with that statement?
It's not true. Lots of things can't be verified.
Like?
Love.
Like that statement. Yeah. You can come up with other examples too. You shouldn't be intolerant. So what are we saying when we say that? We're saying two statements. There's an explicit and an implicit. You shouldn't be intolerant, and you should be intolerant of intolerance. So you should be both intolerant and tolerant. That doesn't work. So this is one of my favorites. We don't think about this as self-refuting, but we see it all the time. This page intentionally left blank. So we don't realize what a postmodern statement this is, actually. Or here's another thing that I would be breaking the rule of a non-contradiction if I said, Chris is married, but he's a bachelor. Well, by definition, a bachelor isn't married, so I'm saying something that's true and false at the same time. Okay, so you can look through these, and again, these are ones that I think are, sometimes we sit here and we look at these and we kind of chuckle, but the truth is that a lot of these we'll hear a lot. This is why sometimes I say, when you interact with people, they'll give you a slogan, right? It could be a bumper sticker, it could be something they saw on Facebook. And actually, we're in a society now where, a Twitter society where everything's broken down to 140 characters or less. Right. So people's attention span and what they spit back out that they've received is usually these little pithy statements, and they think they've sort of, that's it, I solved it, I don't have to deal with your moral claim or your spiritual claim. So things like this, there is no absolute truth. Postmodernism is a hard thing to nail down in a definition, but if you wanted to say, what's the slogan of postmodernism, it would be something like, there is no absolute truth. Here's an example. Can God create a rock so heavy he can't lift it? Now, why would I call that a suicidal statement or self-refuting? Actually, I think there's a couple ways around this question, but I'm looking for a certain one. I mean, one way of saying it is, some people will respond, God is all-powerful in that he can do anything that is logically possible. So nobody, not even God, can do something that's logically impossible. It's just not in the realm of existence. It's like saying a square circle. But how is it self-refuting? So if something's self-refuting, it's breaking the law of non-contradiction. It's saying that it's both true and false at the same time. So what we're doing here is we're attributing, we're basically treating God like two people. We're saying one thing of God and another thing of God at the same time. So we're saying God is this way, but he is this way. That's why it's self-refuting. Or what if somebody says God doesn't take sides? How might you interact with somebody that says God doesn't take sides? What would your first question be? Or what would a question be?
How do you know
that?
Give an example.
Yeah. And they would say, the two private Christian high schools that are playing basketball, both teams are praying that they're going to win. And God's not going to choose one or the other. Something like that.
That's older kids, though. Little kids, I think younger kids, they pray to win. You know, before they're so self-conscious.
Well, I think, let's say that we're thinking of this being like a person that's challenging you on your Christianity because they say, you think you have some, like, you're this great person that's privileged, like, you talk to God, God's on your side and not on our side. The way he says it in the book is, you think God is on your side, but you're wrong. God doesn't take sides. Here, let me give you some examples of interacting with that. Let me ask you a question. In this disagreement we're having on whether or not God takes sides, what do you think God's opinion is? I just told you God is against taking sides. Right. So in our dispute, God would agree with you, not me. That's right. He would side with you in this issue then. I guess God does take sides after all. Right? I mean, there's a problem with the view and you want to expose the issue. Here's some others. How about reality is an illusion? I have in parentheses there, pantheistic monism. I mean, this is essentially a Hindu view. Let me look it up here. So how is this, how does this refute itself? How can you show somebody that this refutes itself? Reality is an illusion. What's the logic? Why is it saying something is true and false at the same time?
They're just saying two separate things. They're saying they know what reality is, but yet reality is an illusion, so they can't know what it is.
Right. Exactly, right? So if it's an illusion, then how are they able to... Well, you could compare it to like somebody in a dream, right? You're having a dream and there's another character in the dream. Is that other character aware that they are a character in your dream? Things that are part of an illusion are not aware that they're in an illusion. The last one, all religions are true. I think, did I mention this before? Right? Well, if you say all religions are true, which religions do you have to admit into the equation? All of them. One of which is? Yes. And what does Christianity say about the way to God? Yeah. So does that fit with pantheistic monism or Buddhism, or if you actually look at the different views, that's a self-refuting statement, because once you admit Christianity, you're trying to promote pluralism by including something that by its own account is exclusivistic. Those don't match. Those don't go together. So you have saying it's true and saying it's false at the same time. Now, some of these, depending on where you're coming from, might be more contentious. There are groups that are theistic evolutionists. So we could have that conversation, that intramural conversation. But this one that says evolution is true, but it was used by God to design the world. If I don't believe in theistic evolution, and I want to take issue with that view, using this tactic, right? Suicide. Like, I want to show why that view kills itself. Well, I believe it kills itself because one of the tenets of evolution is chance. I'm speaking in very general terms here. This is a much more nuanced conversation, but in general, we're talking about a chance adaptation sort of view versus a view that depends on the idea of design. So how do you have chance and design together, right? So you're saying something is one way.
But that's done with very carefully stipulated definitions.
That's true. That's why I want to say, that's why I want to give the...
Evolutionary views would endorse the same.
Yeah. I definitely want to make the caveat that... you could have a very nuanced conversation about this, but we're sort of taking it as a generalized neo-Darwinian view that depends on chance for adaptation. But that's a conversation we can have in the parking lot.
Say Darwin is not the same as evolution.
Sure, yeah. If we started to get really precise, we'd have a much longer sentence. So this is very... I included it on the list because I think there's similar logic there, but it's more contentious on this page. Were you going to say something? Okay. All right, so that's the second tactic, and for next week, I think we'll run through that briefly. You know, we'll have a little sort of role play or something, and then we'll move on to the next tactic. But are there any comments, questions about what we went over tonight? Reactions? Do you think I'm crazy? Do you like what I said? Yes?
In very simple words, could you just give a real briefing on how long was modernism and what centuries, and how long was postmodernism and what centuries, and who defined the word postmodernism?
Oh, that's a... gee, what a simple question. Gosh, that's really putting me on the spot. Okay, so modernism would be, just to give you two key figures, Descartes would be the rationalist, and Locke would be the empiricist of the modern age.
What's his name?
John Locke, L-O-C-K-E.
Empiricist.
Empiricist. Yes.
That's modernism.
They were during the modernist era, yeah. Modernism, it's hard to just say, here's what modernism is, but it's more of an era than an exact idea.
What's an era?
But, yeah, the modern era and then the postmodern era. But the modern era is defined by the thinkers that were in that era and a general trend towards... sort of the idea that that we could sort of figure things out and make a utopian society, something like that.
Life is what you make it.
That we could.
Kind of like that.
No, not quite. Well, let me move forward. So you have modernism, and then postmodernism sort of starts with a lot of people talk about Nietzsche, because he sort of describes what's happening at the end of the modern era. I think historically what was happening is people were reacting against the sort of authoritarian church and its abuses and missteps, and basically they left God out of the equation from then on out. So you have things like transcendent. Nietzsche was pointing to the fact that you lose things like transcendent value and meaning when you do that. Like, hey, if that's where we're going, great, but here's what we're losing. So the postmodern era is different than previous eras because you have existence preceding essence. So there's no longer just a fundamental transcendent way that things are. It starts with you. Like, you determine reality through your existence rather than it being something that you discover as an essential thing in the modern era and previously. And if you think about that, that's sort of, think about some of the social issues that we have right now and how that plays in. So
people are adopting these views and don't even know that that's what they're doing.
Yeah. Right. So much of it's absorbed rather than thought through. So
there's a book, and if I can remember the title, it kind of the way everything catapulted around 1850, and the thinking from the time of around 1850 through 1920 has all affected the result
Right. That's why a lot of this is so important, right? And what we're trying to do in the university with our ministry is important because Gresham Machen, he was a Princeton theologian. This is right as the schools are starting to like become theologically liberal and move away from their traditional roots slowly. He said, what's today a matter of impassionate debate is what moves armies tomorrow. What's a matter of impassionate debate now is what moves armies tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
So we're the product of thinking that happened in a previous generation.
Okay. Now, who said that?
Gresham Machen. It's G-R-E-S-H-A-M. And then the last name, Machen, M-A-C-H-E-N, from Princeton.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, people think that philosophy and the academy is just all ivory towers and, oh, those guys can go talk about their funny ideas. But those ideas are what percolate into culture. So when we lose the academy, we lose culture. So we need to be in the academy affecting minds that are going to be future movers and shakers. Okay, well, it's time. I don't want to hold you guys over. So thank you, guys, and hope to see you next time.